in the janitor. Well, stop to think about it. Kids come to school in the morning, right? Or people pass by the school on the way to work, or they're bringing their own kids to school, and there's the janitor holding up the building. It's his job every morning to stand there and see the little kids don't get run over by trucks, get them all into school. That presence, that visibility, that symbol of the janitor made him the most credible spokesman. He works in a school. He is not probably sold out to the administration, you see. He's just a janitor. And so he has trustworthiness and credibility. The second most trustworthy source of information about schools and their after this crisis was the lady who dishes up the mashed potatoes at school lunch. She is the CIA within the school. Because she only works a couple hours a day, she gets in there and sees what's happening, but she doesn't really care, and then she comes out and tells it like it is. The third was the bus driver, the fourth was the school secretary, and they found out there that when people called the principal's office, they secretly hoped that the principal would be out so they could say, "Mary, what's really going on?" And Mary, of course, would tell all because she's part of the inside CIA. Way down the list were teachers, and barely making the chart were principals. Not making the chart were school board members and school superintendents. Who do you think does most of the spokesmanship for public schools? You got it, school board members and superintendents. Now this poses a real problem for us in the Farm Bureau community. Because where are we going to find spokespersons that have the expertise and the trustworthiness that are not totally tied to the institutional structure? If we put our county president or our state president up there, clearly this person is biased. If we put staff to do the speaking, they have a clear bias. Who are we going to find out there? Apparently, we're going to have to find some third-party voices who can speak on this issue and yet not immediately lose their trustworthiness because they are so totally linked. It's not an easy thing, but it's something that we are absolutely going to have to do. Let me deflate one other, yes, please.
Okay, in that situation with the general welfare, obviously from what you said, it wouldn't be those elected officials in the farm system that possibly then we're looking for the progressive good farmer in the local community that most people respect.
How about the veterinarian? Most people trust the vet because, you know, where else do you take your dog when he's sick?
But, Pat, don't you lose some of the credibility, well, the structure of the Farm Bureau? You have a president who has probably worked his way up the ranks. Being on TV is one of his rewards, right?
That's the perk, man. I may think the organization, but I'm going to get my foot right in. Look, I never said it was easy. I'm just saying. Yes, of course. Accept that. This is where the counseling skills I talked about before become so essential. I can't tell you how hard it is. Let me give you a personal example. A few years ago, at Boston University, where I'm an adjunct professor, that means I teach for very little money in my free time, the teachers decided to go on strike against the dictator there, Napoleon, who was the president of the school. And he really is a good guy. He's the kind of guy who writes things in the op-ed page saying, "If only the rest of you would get out of the way and let the few of us know how to run the world do it, we wouldn't have all these problems." He really wrote that. They decided that they would go on strike. Okay? Their leader, of course, had to be in there. He was going to give all the statements. We kept doing our studies out in the community and finding out nobody believed in. They didn't even believe on campus. He was the head of the union. I mean, how would have to just believe him? It was okay to get your position across, but he wasn't going to be credible at all. But an interesting thing happened. After about the third day of the strike, the media asked me if I'd come to a meeting. So we went to a meeting and they said, "Look, the guy you're in, this guy, is a history professor. And you know, it's the first 20 seconds that count. I mean, this guy, we take him for 5 minutes, and it's the last 20 seconds that we have to finally clip in order to get him usable on television." So they said that unless I or someone from our group would be the spokesperson, they wouldn't run it anymore. So I ended up being the spokesman for the striking teachers on Boston or national television for about 2 weeks, simply in this case because The history professor answered reporters' questions like, would you believe a history professor? And it was just useless. That one way may be around the situation, although I'm not sure I wasn't uncomfortable doing that.
But what if you don't, what if you do have a president who has the expertise and who is credible? Do you want...
If he's credible, that's all we want. If your president is credible, let him go. And I'm not saying abandon those folks. We need an official institutional spokesperson on almost every issue that is known to be biased, that is expressing indeed the feeling of the institution. But we have to stop thinking that that's going to persuade anybody, because it isn't. You see? And so if we want to really get some credibility out there for our argument, we have to get someone else that has the credibility. So we put the janitors out to the school system. We've got to find somebody else to put out. And I brought this up only because it's so difficult in a membership organization like yours. First, to get a president or a staff leader to understand that the goal is to be effective, not to be right. I don't want to be right. I want to come out whole on the other side of the issue. And it is an extremely difficult problem. However, there's a study been done which I think helps. The nuclear issue, because it is so popular, has spawned a lot of research. It's also, I think, spawned research because it's one of those where there are zealots of equal intensity on both sides. I mean, my friends lay down in front of the trucks at Seabrook, and then every time we go to the airport, we get grabbed, you know, to buy some of that anti-Jane Fonda literature. I still have a hunch Jane Baby is supporting them. It's the best publicity she ever had. But that may only be spurious, I don't know. A guy named John Wilkes at Worcester Polytechnic Institute happened to be doing a study of public response to the nuclear issue before Three Mile Island. He had just completed his data collection when Three Mile Island hit. So he was able then to go out at 6 months and a year later and replicate the same study 6 months after Three Mile Island and a year after. So we've got three sets of data. Here's what that data shows. The Three Mile Island incident notwithstanding, he has found that on the nuclear issue, and I think this is about as hot an issue as there is, so it's probably a good bellwether, that the correlation between knowledge and direction of attitude, let me just make sure I explain my terms here, the correlation between what a person knows and the direction of their attitude, that is whether they're pro or con, there was no correlation between them. In other words, the person could know a lot about the issue and be for it, they could know a lot about the issue and be against it. But, the more knowledge that was put in, the more information that was fed out, did not change their attitudes, but it did change the intensity of their attitudes. So that there was no correlation between knowledge and direction, but there was a correlation, a positive correlation, between how much they knew and the intensity of their attitudes. Well, now this is the first reliable study we have that shows that putting out information reinforces people's existing beliefs rather than changing them. Now, obviously, that means we have to do it because we have to keep our own troops locked up. We have to keep them right behind us. But we've been doing it and thinking it was changing other people's attitudes. Wilkes' studies raised serious questions about this, and by the way, a number of people are now doing similar studies and finding similar things. So that's point one, is that information campaigns in an issue tend to reinforce pre-existing attitudes, not to change them. Notice the implication. Sure, we womp up the troops when we put the information out, but we also womp up the opposition. Conclusion, put the information out to your own troops, not public. That's why Bill Bonnick says 90% of it is dealing with my own members, my own employees, inside information. Because if we go public with it, it's going to have as much positive effect for the other side as it is for you. That's, yeah.
This morning you were talking about
that attitudes probably weren't as important as behavior.
Right.
What, how does the amount of knowledge affect behavior then?
Well, the question of translating attitudes to behavior is related here. The more strongly you feel, you see, the more you are apt to act on. And so that's why it's critical to put out information to your own troops, to get them wound up, to get them feel so strongly they will do something. Whereas to put out knowledge hoping you will win people over, change the direction of their attitudes, is a vain hope, according to Wilkes' study. Yes?
What about that body of people out there that have no apparent attitude at
the outset? Oh, yeah, I know. Well, you know, there are those three marvelous groups that we keep talking about. There are those that are for us, and those that are against us, and those without any attitudes. Today, I find them, well, I've never found many of them. I mean, truly, there are, now, just take animal rights. Take animal rights as an issue, okay? There are a lot of people that don't know anything about this issue. I can assure you that you already know that yourself. They don't know, they don't care at this point. But the minute it becomes an issue, meaning there are two contending sides, remember, it takes two to tango. That's another reason not sometimes to respond. The press gets tired of quoting one side always and no rebuttal. When it becomes an issue, I guarantee you that the animal issue relates so directly to everybody's gut feeling, there ain't going to be any zeros. They're all going to be pluses or minuses. That would at least be my approach.
Yeah, but hopefully you're doing something prior to when it gets to that proper form, right?
Well, I hope, sure. Well, no, that's not what I would be doing. I would be working like hell if I thought a Jesus has never got to a public form.
I agree. I'm saying prior to the time that it becomes a moot issue, maybe you're going to improperly be putting out information. What you just said is that that's going to have no effect on changing people's attitudes.
Very good.
My question is it going to have any effect on developing an attitude where there apparently isn't?
Yes, it will, but it will be the pre-existing attitude. See, that's what I'm saying. So it's a hell of a gamble. Because you don't know what, unless you've got a good study. This is, again, where research is so critical. I try and keep clients from putting any information out there until I have a damn good study. Or studies, which correlate with a lot of other studies other people have done, that tell me that there's a predisposition in direction of attitude toward my position. Then I want to get all of the information out there, because I know I'm going to also stir up a bunch of antis. But the numbers look good to me. There's going to be more pros than antis, and hey, I'll do it. But oftentimes we don't have any of that data, and we come charging out of the corral, and we put all that information out, and what do? Hell, we create an activist group against us where there wasn't one to start with. And that's a great danger. Yes?
After 3 Mile Island, in the Harrisburg area, there is no such thing as somebody who doesn't have a strong opinion about either for or against.
Yeah, I believe that.
Mm-hmm. So even in my own household, my wife didn't give a damn. And I was somewhat for. My wife is violently opposed, though, today. I'm still for.
Yep.
We don't talk about we go out. But what I'm saying, there are no neutrals. I haven't found them anyway. They're not, they don't exist.
Let me prove that from another point of view. The reason that I think I chose one, we don't use opinion studies anymore in our research. We have a research subsidiary called Better Research, and we don't even do opinion studies. They're a waste of time. In fact, any study we do today, we'll ask an attitude. We may ask an opinion question, a leading question, then we'll check it with an attitude question, then we'll check it with a demographic question, then we'll check it with a behavioral question, all in one survey. We've got to check. And the reason for that is that people lie. People lie like hell. I'm serious. Today, it is a social reward in our society to be knowledgeable, right? To be plugged in, cosmopolitan. Nobody's going to say, I don't know anything about that. Very few anyway. I prove this to my students when I teach a research course by sending them out on the street with an absolutely phony issue. Non-existent issue. And every time they'll come back saying 72% for, 28% against, and 6% undecided. I'm serious. But you can try it yourself. Ask somebody on the plane, say, what do you think about so-and-so? Usually they'll say, well, I'm against it, or something like that. Very, very few people have, you know, say, well, gee, I don't know anything about it. Oh, wait, I said Jim would be next.
Give us an idea of how much you as a consultant, well, how much you as a practitioner in the East pay for the kinds of research that would answer the question, where does the vast majority lie on this issue?
Okay.
What kind of price range?
Well, obviously, this depends on who does it. And I should warn you, be very, very wary of polling firms. And here's why. Polling firms believe, or would like you to believe, that absolute statistical representation methods, better known to those of us who do this as statistical calisthenics, have to be done on every research project. And the reason is because it costs a lot of money to do that. And so we're always applying these representational samples to places where we don't need them. And so the answer is whether you have the mechanism yourself to do some informal research and check it against maybe one representational sample. Let me give you an example of what I mean. There's a guy down in Miami who was a radio talk show host for years. He has what I consider to be one of the really useful research techniques now available to us in public relations. He doesn't give a hoot about the numbers, about the statistics. I mean, do we really care? If 25% are concerned with the policy of my organization, I'm worried right now. But if 30% were, I'd be just as worried, and 20% were, I'd still be just as worried. That's too big a number to ignore. So this statistical business is unimportant. So here's what he does. He goes in and does in-depth interviews using all his radio interviewing techniques. And the only thing he notes is keywords that set the subject off until he finds the issue or the word where they absolutely go like this. And when they really clutch up and get in the guts, and he finds about three people in any one week that do that, he reports to his clients right away, look out. We've got some folks out there that feel strongly enough about this issue that it's going to become a public issue. In other words, the feeling is that intensity is everything. If I were trying to find out in a state, well, you know, it really doesn't matter since you're going to use a sample of 400 to 1,500 anyway. You should be able to do that for somewhere, depending on your, you know, whether you're using a big national firm or a local firm that can use the same technique, you should be able to do that somewhere, frankly, anywhere between $5,000 and $20,000. If you've been, you know, getting in on these lovely $40,000 statistical manipulations, you got to watch out. Also, there are cheaper ways to do it. If you've got a single issue, how about piggybacking it on ORC or Roper or Gallup's weekly or monthly poll? Just adding it as a question or two. Obviously, that's not the kind of in-depth stuff that will give you checking questions. But if you really want to find out, are people aware? Never forget also that we don't want to ask people, I don't want to ask people very often, if they're ready to make a decision, how do you feel about this issue, pro or con? Forget that. They're still in the awareness phase on animal rights. I want to know, are you aware? That's what I want to know. And of course, that's dangerous. You do too much research, man, you'll make them all. Research is one of the great publicity techniques of all time. You all know about Dove and how it got introduced as a soap. They sent researchers out all over the country. When the researchers went to the door, in the days when the researchers did go to the door and knock, you know, today they wouldn't dare do that. Might get shot or something, but in New York City there's a law against doing that. They go and they knock and they say, morning, madam. That's when women say, oh, we're housewives. Good morning, madam. How do you feel about Dove? They say, Dove? What Dove? Let me tell you about Dove. And out came the spiel about Dove. And within about 2 months of that kind of introductory pattern, Dove was a leading soap in the United States. Because people clearly find a publicity value in that kind of research. Let me just finish with Wilkes here a minute, and then we'll really get into this other. The first point that he discovered is that information reinforces and does not change attitudes. Therefore, you're going to turn on the other side as well as your own if you go too public with your information campaign. The second thing he found, though, was devastating. The power companies were their own worst enemies because when people were not well informed,
they tended to be more favorable to nuclear power. Okay? That's for obvious reasons. The kind of people that might favor nuclear power are probably informed persons who know what's going on, their opinion leaders, and so forth. The more the power company put out the information, the more the numbers rose. By the time you take a little state like New Hampshire, where everybody, at the drop of the word Seabrook, immediately runs away because they don't want any more arguments on it, take a state like that, they found that the more money the public service company in New Hampshire spent with their information campaign, the more the odds evened out. Because they did exactly what the first principle of his studies talked about. They found a lot of folks out there who had a gut negative feeling about nuclear power, but were not activists. The more they heard about it, became aware of it, the more they translated the direction of their feeling into intensity. So that his conclusion, and by the way, his study was paid for by the nuclear power industry, his conclusion for them was that you put out so much information that indeed you are losing this issue debate. I think that is fascinating, and the advice is obvious. First, we have to know the latent attitudes of people. Are they apt to be predisposed favorably or negatively? And only when we know that is it anything short of one hell of a risk to go public with a big issue campaign. Because you may be spending your dough and your time to turn on the other side. And you probably won't change very many of them over to your viewpoint. What this study indicates is very close to what I scaled up here this morning on Phil Leslie's chart, that indeed the 10% in the middle there who are going to make the decision are the ones we want to target. Because the more you start talking to these folks out here, the more you may turn them on. Those two 40% groupings, remember? The more you may turn them on and move them in as a factor in the discussion. You, Miss, you had a question, I think, and I didn't.
Well, I guess it was just in all of your workings and watching the activist movement. How often does the other side or the organization, how much time do they usually have to get all that research that they need? Or do they usually have the time?
No, that's their problem. Is that they don't have any money for research. At first, they didn't have any money for professional public relations counsel. Now they do. They have very sophisticated methods. In fact, they've been the leaders in methods. Corporate America is just now beginning to learn what the methods are that the activists have been using for 50 years, really for 100 years. And I have a hunch that most associations are not much further ahead. Their great risk on the activist side is that they don't have the money for that kind of research as a rule. So they just shoot their mouths off. It's a kind of roulette. And if it turns out that the public is with them, fine. If it isn't, however, they have another strategy. And that is they just fall back and go to grassroots and start really working through the social methods on attitude change. And then when they have a hunch through this kind of perseverance that the balance has shifted, because attitudes can change if you use a two-step flow and you pursue it over time. Then they go public again, and the group may make it, the public may make a different decision. I think you can see that in issues. Well, let's think of some issues. The draft is, I think, a good instance of that issue. Remember, for years, to even suggest there wouldn't be a draft was unpatriotic. And then all of a sudden, the people rose up and said, there will be no draft. And we were all amazed that public opinion could tell the U.S. Army where to head in. And now you'll notice that as that issue is brought up by the conservatives, by the right-wing politicians, that they're very careful how they bring it up. And nobody from Reagan on down seems to want to really test the waters. Because they're aware of just what I'm talking about, that there is a great latent resistance to that subject.
From what you've been saying, I know, like in our state, on the animal welfare issue, he's kind of taking the attitude that we're going to collect all of the research that's available about what the activists are saying we're doing wrong so that we can say, no, that's not correct. But really, that's probably, from what you're saying, not the type of research we really need to be working on.
The people you want to get that to are your troops. You want to hit them with that again and again and again so they understand it, so they are convinced in their own minds. I think we often underestimate the ability of an activist group to shatter the confidence of our own members. You know, they get all shook up. They're not used to this. And so the key audience in a confrontation is your own people. As far as going public with that, I don't think I would let the animal rights people do their own publicity. Let them pay for it. Why the hell should you make it a big public issue for them, which is just what I think you could end up doing.
That's confused, Pat. How do you conduct latent issue research? You told us how not to,
yep.
And I understand that, but how do you do it?
Okay. The best way I know to deal with latent issue research is that method that I told you about this morning of the whole personality. That's where the whole personality is so important. This is how we do it. I can show you an overlapping series of profiles. The people who got active in the pacifist movement in the mid-50s, some of you may remember that. The people who were concerned then, as they are now, about the nuclear war and to wipe out the world. It was mostly Quakers and Mennonites and other peace churches. And they went off to New London, Connecticut, and they were trying to get the government to pay some attention. The media was very repressive in the 50s and would pay no attention to them at all, wouldn't give them any space. And so finally they took out good old Henry David Thoreau and the other Quaker activists, and they said, I guess we'll have to take a page out of their book. And they tried civil disobedience. They cut the fence and they marched through to this submarine, this nuclear submarine that was at New London. Well, you all know what happened. After being completely kept out of the media for a couple of years, and by the way, I was right there arguing with them, listen, don't do it, don't go civil disobedience, the newspapers will see the light, just keep trying to persuade them, and after a couple of years they said, sorry, buddy. And they cut through the fence, and you all know the result. The next day they were all over the papers. It was now an issue. Martin Luther King and some of the other black activists were there working with the pacifists. Boy, did that ever open their eyes. And so they went down south and got Rosa Parks to sit in the front of the bus and march to Selma and all that other stuff. And the same people went from the pacifist issue to civil rights. Then they moved to civil liberties, First Amendment threats, that kind of thing. That same group then moved into the anti-Vietnam movement, and then moved into the environmental movement, and today, most of them, if they're not back into pacifism, are into holistic health, Zen, and growing your own gardens, and all of that kind of stuff. Don't laugh, the holistic health movement is now identified by sociologists as the largest single movement in America. That's the only way I know to test it, is to find those kind of, you know, gut belief things, and ask people questions that tend to indicate how society feels in a profile. I'm always very wary of saying, here's an issue you haven't heard about yet, but how do you think you might feel? Because what I'm really saying is, hey, God, why is that? It's a hot issue. Why don't you get in on it? And of course, I don't want to be in on it if it's my issue. Well, that's what you have to do. You have to do profiles. And as you know, the standard polling techniques do a great deal of that. In fact, we often do profiling in the middle of a hot issue debate. I mean, if I have to walk through here now and say certain key words, like if I say abortion, that issue is so hot in most people that sometimes when I talk to citizens groups, I can say abortion like that, and I can say, you go over there, you're against it, you go over there, you're for it. Because, I mean, we just wear it right on our sleeves. And so to do polling on issues that are that hot is also untrustworthy. Because people are too emotional about it. So as far as I know, you have to develop a profiling technique, which takes us right back to that business this morning of association. You have to find other issues that seem to have a correlation. It's not easy, but it's what we have to do. Let me give you an example of this in action. Last year, Ralph Nader and another group put together a thing they called Big Business Day. Some of you may have heard about it. It was an activist activity to claim that big business was greedy and not socially responsible and so forth. And it was kind of interesting, the responses that were made by various business organizations. U.S. Chamber of Commerce countered it. Their strategy was to counter it, and so they relabeled it anti-business day to try and show that it was something other than it was. United